Interstate Batteries offers a wide variety of batteries for your everyday needs. Stop into one of their thousands of retail locations and talk with a battery specialist about batteries for your truck, trail cameras, and even those weird batteries for your rangefinder. Interstate Batteries even offers cell phone repair in certain locations. For more information, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the O2 Podcast. Today, Paul and Andrew are here. Well, Andrew's here. Paul is there. And Paul, where are you at right now?
I am in Argenta, Illinois, center of the state, western half of the state, corn country, bean country, God's country.
You're just a traveling man.
Yeah, headed home, man. I've been in a little town called Powersville, Missouri, for the last 5 days for a work event, and it's been cool, man. It's been a good trip. It's always nice to get together with the coworkers. There's a lot of things happening with my job and a lot of good stuff with the organization, and I'm excited to be a part of it, but I'm ready to get home, man.
Good.
So, I'm jealous as hell. You sent me a video the other day at a tree stand deer hunt.
Yeah, buddy. Took a quick jaunt up the old 23 to Killdeer Plains to take a look. Typical Andrew hunting scenario. When I was up there last year for turkeys, I saw umpteen million deer. So I go up for deer and I see, well, I didn't see anything. I saw one squirrel, but didn't see any deer. And you know what? I at first I was mad. I was like, man, maybe it, I always think it's one of those spots. You know, you picked the wrong spot. I played the wind wrong. I came in wrong, whatever. But even on the drive out, I expected to see them crossing the roads, and they just weren't. It was pretty warm that day, so I have a feeling that they were just hunkered down pretty well.
I mean, it was like upper 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, so yeah. I went up for the afternoon and parked my truck and went did a hanging hunt with my saddle. Shout out to Tethered. I snuck in down this creek, and I thought, oh, this is good. Like, I was down a little bit. The creek was actually dry, but it was wet enough that you could catch hoof prints. So there was lots of hoof prints through there. I set up on this. I sent you a video of it. But it was this kind of edge transition area. I was out away from the wind. I really thought that this was a pretty good spot. That should have been my first indicator that nothing was going to happen when I thought it was good. Because usually it's when I think that I'm in a worse spot or, you know, in a worthless spot that happens. But, you know, it was nice to get up in the tree. It's always good to get out in the woods and just clear your mind. But also to figure out, you know, get the kinks out of the system. And there was a few kinks in my system that I realized needed to be dealt with. One of which my platform, I had not taped it up at all or tried to make it quieter. So there was a lot of tinging going on as I was getting up the tree with that. Let's see, what else did I learn? I try to pick out things that I learned in that trip. My thermocell worked really well. I think I heard one mosquito in my ear when I was up in the tree, and they were all over me walking in because I didn't have it turned on. So that worked really well. I remembered that it is difficult to find a good climbing tree with good shooting lanes on public land. But I'm trying to think what else. My system worked all in all. I mean, like, got in, got everything set up and ready to go. Just kind of, like I said, fine-tuning those little things. And I came home and wrapped the hell out of my stand with hockey tape or my platform.
Oh, there you go.
Try to quiet it up a little bit, so... Yeah, it was good. It was a good start to the season, and I probably won't be out again until the statewide opener, but it was good. So that's
2 weeks.
Yeah.
Hell, I might run up to the DSA just to get up in the saddle. And I mean, man, I haven't bow hunted religiously in a while, in some years. I mean, I went out last year, but prior to that, it's like 5 years since I've bow hunted. So I need to work that out quite a bit. So yeah. No, it was cool seeing the pictures, man. Bummed you didn't at least didn't see anything. So
you know, it was one of those things. Like so you always go out to hunt to try to get something, right? In reality, though, had I killed one on Saturday night, I'd have 24 hours to get it to, this is as far as how I understand the regulations, to get it to a processor that's certified by the state. So that would have been on a Sunday. And trying to find somebody open on a Sunday on September 11th would have been a challenge. So it's probably better that I didn't actually come home successful. But then again, it would have still been cool to say if I had been able to get a buck or something on the first day.
Yeah, that would have been cool. Still time in the woods, though, man. That's awesome. I think that's what, I mean, if you're listening to this show, you're probably itching to get in the woods, I would imagine. Yeah. Whether it's dove, squirrel, early waterfowl, most of you are going to be, you know, bow hunting deer. So I know I'm just chomping at the bit, man, to get up in that tree saddle and start slinging some heavy arrows, man. I'm ready, dude. I am ready.
You know, the other thing I learned, hunting in the early season, it's hot and sweaty, okay? And your gear does matter. So we work with First Light, right? And we're going to talk to them here in a couple days, maybe next week's episode. But the wick clothes and the lightweight stuff was a godsend, man. I mean, it was like I was wet when I was – because I was sweating. But I was never uncomfortable, right? Because then, I didn't get cold. I usually get cold or just miserable. But it wasn't. It wasn't that bad because it was, you know, it breathed. The material was breathing and all that kind of stuff. So I did go buy a Wick hoodie. I didn't have that. So if you know their line, you got like the Wick is the lightest one. I think Kiln is the next one up. And I had a Kiln. So it was a little bit too much. So from the tree, I had to order one of those. But you know, I have no problem giving me another excuse to buy more clothes. But that went well. And then we'll just get all of our little shout outs here. The Go Wild guys, we were all sitting there while I was sitting there in the tree talking with the Go Wild guys and Derek, and he got his bear. Braden was Braden.
Congratulations, Derek.
Braden was doing his saddle shooting from up in the tree, but those guys all work for Go Wild, and if you aren't a member on there, you're missing out. Lots of big stuff to come there. Shout out to them for having their 5-year anniversary. I think that's this week, isn't it, Paul?
That's this week. I'll be down for that party, so I can't wait to get down there and celebrate with them, man. That's quite an accomplishment. 5 years in this climate, and man. Couldn't be happier for that group of people.
To make it through all the pandemic stuff and all that, that's big news, man. Yeah. That's really impressive. So, but yeah, get on Go Wild, timetogowild.com, and you can find us on their O2 podcast or Paul Campbell are the two accounts that we run with on there. So, let's see. What else have we got going around the state, Paul?
I'm like so out of the loop. It's amazing. I 5 days out of the state. I don't even know what the hell's going on. So
well, I'll run through.
Yeah. All right. We got a wildlife council meeting coming up.
Yeah. So September. I almost said November. September 14th at 7 o'clock at 1500 Dublin Road in Columbus. They've got the public rules hearing at the wildlife for district office. So if you are interested in that, feel free to go give your comments at that. The The DSA archery zone is open. So for now until September 24th, you can hunt deer in there with archery. Like we were talking about, if you guys go up there, if you're in that area, make sure you're checking your rule book on what you got to do, because there are regulations as far as having those deer monitored or not leaving, whatever. Just get in there and check those out. There are numbers on the ODNR website that you can call if something's not clear to you. I called last week about something. They did not pick up, but I left a message. They did promptly return my call and left me a message, giving me all the information I needed. So the system works. Just have a little faith and patience. But make sure you check that out. Then September 24th is when we all get to play the game. Don't forget, as you're scouting and thinking about where to hunt this fall, we've got the OLAP program going on again. We did that interview, I think it was last week, with Dave Kohler from ODNR talking about the program itself. But get on, check that map out. Make sure you know how that program works if you want to take advantage of that. EHD, Paul, last week we talked to Mike Tonkovich about, we actually put that out as a bonus episode last Friday, which we don't usually do. We got a pretty regimented schedule of when these come out, but the guys over at the Sportsman's Empire were nice enough to get that out for us because it's pretty relevant. It's time relevant. If you've got any questions about the EHD stuff, Mike Tonkovich really, he did a nice job with that. And Mike is a wealth of information. And I'll tell you one thing I walked away from that, Paul, is that we don't know a whole hell of a lot about that disease.
No, we don't. You know, this weekend I was with, you know, a bunch of biologists for the NWTF, and we had some conversations about EHD, and there was one of my coworkers that was there, he's not a biologist, but I had mentioned that we were going through, you know, a little EHD outbreak in Ohio, and he said, oh, have you guys been in a drought? And that was how the conversation started. Well, no, not really. Like, it's been dry, but it definitely, the entire state, maybe isolated pockets like Mike talked about. You know, so I mean, there's a lot of questions. The one thing that we do know is that EHD is here, and deer are dying, whatever reason that is. It's actively happening in our state. So, you know.
Yeah, and I think the inquiring mind that I have, Mike and I talked, I think it was actually off of the phone call, but one of the things that he said is as it's believed, first of all, drought is supposed to be, you know, exacerbate this problem, which is weird because I don't feel like we've had drought in where I'm at in Ohio, yet our county is confirmed case. But the bigger thing is that it's caused by the midge. Supposedly, if you think of it like a tick, the midge, only the females bite because they need the blood to reproduce. When the offspring are born, they are not infected with the virus. All right. And those females are only supposed to bite one time. So if they only bite once and they're not born with it, how do they spread it? So that was one of those things that, as we got going, I was really kind of made me wonder about how much we really know about this disease. And as Mike said, it, you know, it doesn't involve humans and it doesn't involve livestock. So a lot of times it's hard to find funding for that kind of stuff. So hopefully down the road we can keep learning more about that. But for now, keep an eye out, report it to the ODNR, and hopefully we can get that first frost to come through here before we have any real excessive damage.
Yeah. If you are dealing with EHD on your property, like, everyone's different. I mean, you can communicate with the state of Ohio that you have dead deer on your property, man. I wouldn't be scared. I mean, I talked to some guys, and they're like, oh, there's no way they're going to come in and kill all my deer. I'm like, that's not what's going to happen. You know, it's more for a how's it spread, you know, trying to answer the question, you know, to learn more about this disease. So if you find dead deer, one, get a salvage permit months for the antlers, if you want.
Yeah.
Follow the rules, you know, and don't be afraid to reach out to the state. They're there to help all of us, you know, manage the resources that we love and want to protect, and that's the white-tailed deer. So don't be afraid to reach out, man. I can't stress that enough.
Yeah, and I know there's a concern. Like, if you've been following a buck for 4.5, 5.5 years, and it's at its peak, and all of a sudden it shows up dead in your creek, that you kind of still want those antlers. Like, you've been – that was your prized possession you've been working for, and you're afraid to call somebody because they're going to take them. We do have salvage permits. I think if you do the stuff the right way, I can't speak for every game warden or sheriff department or whatever, but like, I think we can, though, a lot of times they'll give you that permit as long as, you know, they get what they need out of that deer so that you can keep your rack, if that's what really, if you're really concerned about that. But let's all just help the system, right? So
yeah, you're gonna get to keep your deer. Like, they're not gonna come in and like just take everything. That's not how it works. I mean, so. I think there's just a fear that that's gonna happen. And man, they are there. That is a shared resource. Like, that resource belongs to the people. They manage it. Like, this is, you know, it's all gonna work out.
Yep. I think the last thing I had here written down, Paul, was that the my little horticultural newsletters I get. The spotted lanternfly, just remember, this is another one of those invasive bugs that can affect your woodlands or your home landscape. Really likes the tree of heaven, but it can do damage to a lot of different tree species. So just think about the emerald ash borer that we had, whatever, 10 or 15 years ago, really swept through the state. I still see dead ash trees standing around. We don't need any more of that. If you see... look it up, Google it, you're sitting in the woods, you see some kind of goofy bug, they're kind of pretty looking, they're large. You know,
they're super cool.
You need to let ODA know so that we can try to keep that one from deforesting any more of our hardwood trees on the landscape.
Once again, they're not going to come in and cut all your trees down. That's not going to happen.
No. So, let's see, who are we talking to this week, Paul?
We got a big one, man.
Big dog.
Giannis, Peter guy. Man, it was cool. It was a cool talk. Learned a lot about Giannis and his, you know, his life and his process into becoming a guide, moving all over the country, and, you know, just getting in with Ranella and Meat Eater and those guys. Man, it was cool. It was cool hearing kind of like the backstory of a lot of these people that we see, you know, that are really at the top of their game in terms of, you know, talking about hunting. So,
yeah.
It was cool. I really enjoyed our talk. Dude's awesome.
We get to see guys like him on TV and doing the fun stuff. And, I mean, we always sit there and we're like, man, this is – what a great life he has. Like, that's so cool. That's what his job is my hobby, and that would be so awesome to travel around and hunt all these different species and stuff. But in, like, most things in life – it doesn't just happen, right? And Giannis, I mean, we kind of get his whole story. You know, he didn't graduate from college, which a lot of times we're told that's what you have to do, right? He went and did some pretty tough labor on ranches out in Colorado where he'd spend all day chopping wood. He traveled around, took risks, different things like that, and it paid off in the long run. And now it is what, you know, kind of what we see through all their media and different things. But I think it's a great lesson, and not to get too philosophical, but my daughter is getting to the point where in school it's not as much just fun and games, right? There's actually work involved, and she does like Giannis, and she watched Meat Eater and different things like that with us. But I'm like, look, babe, he gets to do all this fun stuff, but there was days where he was out cutting wood by hand all day long because that's what he had to do, or painting fences on a ranch in the heat and everything else. But he knew he had to keep chopping and keep painting and doing all that stuff if he wanted to be an elk guide. And then, you know, the ball rolls. So I really took a lot away from that in the life lesson more than anything. And I just thought it was a really cool story.
Yeah, it is. It was neat. You know, the one question that I didn't get to ask him, and we talk about kind of like the intricacies of how Meat Eater and the hunting and the filming and all that work. And so it's really cool. But I wanted to ask him once, like, how they manage tags, right? Like, all of these guys, they get some of these super cool tags. Does he just, like, sit down one day with a credit card and just apply for everything across this country? And I want to know that answer. Because there's a lot of people that are part of Meat Eater, content creators, personalities, and they all hunt, like, just all over the country, all these super cool hunts. Some of the stuff's hard to get. I wanted to know that. We didn't get into that. So
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we can
next
follow
time.
Up. Yeah. I enjoyed it, man. What a great talk. What a great dude.
Good talk. I think you guys will enjoy it. Paul, come home, buddy. Come on home.
5 hours, 29 minutes, my friend.
All right. Well, we'll see you then. Be safe. Everybody have a good week. And if you get out in the woods, good luck.
All right. See you guys.
Yep. And what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the O2 Podcast. Today we are joined with Mr. Giannis Patelis from The Meat Eater. Giannis, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Doing good.
Not gonna lie, I'm pretty excited because it's like Giannis. My wife said, You realize you get to talk to Giannis today? Like, he's one of your favorites from all the shows and stuff. And I was like, yeah, but I'm trying to stay under control. So we might let Paul talk.
You
for
shook
a while.
Him loose, Giannis. Yeah, as soon as you logged in, he lost it. So,
hey, I always tell everybody, man, I'm real happy that we have so many fans and that you know, everybody watches all the content because it keeps us all employed. You know,
absolutely,
very very good. So, Giannis, tell us and our listeners that are somehow unfamiliar with you. I guess, man, where'd you grow up?
I grew up mostly, I'd say, in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I was born in Indianapolis, but we moved there when I was about 8, up to Kalamazoo, and then I lived there until I was probably 18. So I guess, you know, sort of those are most of my like kid days. You know, we're in Kalamazoo before I moved out west.
So, are you a Spartan fan or a Wolverine fan? Or don't care.
This conversation might get cut real short. You have to remember you're talking to a couple guys from Ohio. So,
you know, probably if I had to, I'd probably choose State just because it seems like they're the underdogs most of the time.
There you go.
But, yeah, it's really irrelevant to me.
Yeah, there you go. And we get that. I mean, we ask everyone from Michigan that, and it's just some guys are like, meh, it doesn't matter.
Oh, that's right, because you guys have a rivalry with Michigan.
We
right?
do, yeah. Just, that's our big Michigan, or you know, our big rivals. So we kind of have to know, right? I mean, we're both Ohio State guys, so we always dig on that question. So
I don't know how you guys find enough time to you know, pay attention and watch and do all that stuff, especially since it's during hunting season.
I mean, I'm going to spike the football, so to speak, a little bit. It's because we play a lot at night. When the primetime games is Ohio State fans. So we get to squeeze some deer hunting in. I mean, we'll have, you know, we'll have a bunch of games that, you know, start 3:30 or 8 o'clock at night and it allows it. So,
but
I mean,
in fairness, it has reduced a lot over the years. I mean, back in college and right out of college, it was just like, that's what you did.
Yeah.
Kids kind of probably take away some of that too. So,
I mean, I'm goose hunting and watching Ohio State Notre Dame this Saturday. So it doesn't get any better for me to be completely honest with you. So, now, Giannis, did you? I assume that you grew up in a hunting family, right?
Yeah, I'd say, I don't know if it was a hunting family, but my dad hunted, or he actually started hunting. I think when I was like, it was after I was born, he started hunting seriously. I can remember when I was probably like 5 or 6. I sort of remember a few, you know, I don't know if it was Thanksgiving or some sort of, you know, family thing that we were doing. And it was like, well, where's dad? And, oh, he was out hunting, you know. So he's sort of was getting into it, you know, just as I was, like, coming up. So he kind of had it figured out by the time I was old enough to start coming with him at, you know, whatever it was, 10 or 11. And then I started actually hunting. I can't remember now. It's so long ago. I hunted Wisconsin and Michigan mostly growing up. And one state, I think, was 12 to hunt, and one was 14. But I can't remember which one was which is when I started finally, like, toting a firearm around.
Wisconsin's 12, and the only reason I know that, we just talked to Doug Dern a couple of weeks ago. And he talked about – yeah, he talked about starting at 12 in Wisconsin. So I mean, you had kind of like a crazy career trajectory, it sounds like. So, I mean, when you graduated high school, I mean, what did you do after that? Did you go to college? Or, I mean, I read somewhere that you moved to Alaska and you were a guide. I mean, that's pretty cool. Was that after? Or?
Yeah, you got all of it right. All there's that's all part of it. But the sequence might be a little bit different. But I started right out of high school. I did a year of community college and pretty much just wasted, you know, I think it was probably my dad's money, maybe some of my own money too. and was really just spinning my wheels, hanging out in Kalamazoo. And luckily, I had a friend who had spent that same year spinning chairlifts out at Mount Hood in Oregon. And he came back for the summer and was like, dude, I'm going to go back out west. You should come along. And that's all I needed. I was like, yeah, that sounds great to me. Let's go and, you know, snowboard the big mountains is what I was thinking at the time. And so I worked two jobs all summer. I worked the swing shift at my mom's, the factory that she was head of HR at. And then we moved out to Colorado. And so that's kind of how I got out west. And then I spent like, I don't know, a couple, 3 years working in the kitchen. And at the same time, I just really fell in love with fly fishing. And then I got the opportunity to start guiding elk hunts. More as like just like a grunt at an elk camp. But I guess I had just enough passion for it that the outfitter, after a season, actually it was only a half a season of painting and sand. I think I sanded and stained a cabin, and I don't know what else kind of grunt work he had me do, help set up the base camp, all the wall tents and whatever. And then like midway through that season, he had me guiding a little bit. So that's how I really got involved in the outdoors, was pretty much starting around like I was 20 or 21. And at that time I was fly fish guiding for, I don't know, 100 to 150 days a year, and then going and guiding elk hunts, or at least spending the fall, you know, which would be roughly 3 months, you know, up there in the little flat tops of Colorado. So that's how I really got like embedded in the outdoors and in that space. And then I pretty much kept after that same schedule for the next 10 years. And I would still work in restaurants during the off season. I did some work in a retail store in the off season. And off season for me was like the winter, really. Because even in Colorado, you can fly fish pretty much all winter long. I was able to do a little bit of that, but I still always had to supplement the work. And then at the end of that, I did some other guiding gigs here and there, but at the end of that stint was when my wife and I moved up to Alaska for a job that she took. And then we came back down to Salt Lake for a couple of years. And then we ended up in Bozeman about 7 years ago, I guess now. So that's kind of been the trajectory of that. And so I went from guiding, and through the Alaska thing, that's how I got involved with Meat Eater. And it was interesting, you know, looking back on it, because like all those other jobs I did up to that point certainly fell right into place. And I could use a little bit of all those skills, you know, working at Meat Eater, you know, knowing about gear from my retail days and knowing about cooking from my restaurant days. And then obviously the hunting and fishing guiding, you know, fit right into.
So I'm curious, when it comes to your move out to Colorado and you're doing the guiding, both the fly fishing and the elk stuff, you talk about the sanding the cabin and doing all that grunt work, but you just took the skills that you had from growing up as a kid in Michigan and to use those in the guiding sense too, or were they training you along the way too? They weren't just doing...
The guiding definitely was, I think all, I don't know about all, but certainly all the outfitters that I've ever been around or worked for or worked with, it doesn't matter if it's fishing or hunting, they're going to have to take up-and-comers and kind of teach them the ways. Like, rarely does somebody, I think, that really has, like, a complete guiding skill set just knock on an outfitter's door and go, hey, like, I'm ready to guide. Like, maybe someone that's, you know, done 10 years as the elk and mule deer guide, and all of a sudden they want to take the next step and become a doll sheep guide and then go to Alaska, I think in that case. But for the most part, there's just so that there's probably pretty high turnover. It takes a person that has a special set of circumstances where, like, you know, with a family, it obviously gets harder, you know, if you're going to be gone for 3 months all fall guiding. And I think that, you know, usually it's going to be like, young, probably predominantly males, you know, that are willing to, you know, work three different jobs throughout the year, that don't have like a real strong sort of like career trajectory or this idea in their heads that they're going to make a bunch of money someday, you know, working, you know, the financial market or whatever, right? Like, it takes a special person. I think the Outfitters are constantly looking for like the next up and comer, and they're probably looking for just as much. And it's no different than for me working as a producer making media or television, where it's like you feel like you can teach people a lot of things, but the thing you can't teach them is like work ethic, right? So I think the Outfitters are constantly looking for like a kid that can show up, and if they're like, hey, let's chop some wood, the kid's like, I love chopping wood, you know? And then like you chop a cord of wood in a day and a half or whatever, right? Like the Outfitter's like, that's great, because I know they can probably do anything if they set their mind to it. I'll teach them how to elk hunt, you know? And obviously I think learning how to elk hunt, there's, or any kind of hunting, there's no substitute for going out there and doing it on your own, right? Like, you can one of my favorite things to do as a young guide was to come back after a day of, whether it was just me out ding-donging around the woods or guiding, and sort of run my whole day through the senior guides and you know, ask them questions about what I did right or wrong, whether it was the approach to the zone or whether it was, you know, some calling I did or whatever. But no matter how much you do that, that all helps, but you really just have to go out there and do it on your own over and over and over, and have, you know, five failures and then five successes, and then, you know, you get confidence and you develop a, you know, sort of like a, I guess, a formula for your own success, you know.
Did you kill an elk that first year in Colorado?
I was in Colorado a couple of years before I actually started hunting elk. The first year, I'm trying to think. So I was a client. We booked a drop camp hunt the first year that I got into elk hunting. My dad was like looking to come out for an elk hunt, and I found what turned out to be the outfitter I ended up working for. I found him, and I was actually just asking him about ways to get elk out of the woods, because enough people had said like, hey dude, if you get an elk down, like you need to have a plan on how to get the elk out. So I think I was actually calling around looking for like ATV rentals or something, and he basically had an opening at a kind of a DIY cabin that he had that was like offset from the main hunting operation. And so we were clients that year. We had a terrible week of hunting, like saw like one elk in 4.5 days. And long story short, the outfitter came over the last morning, hiked us up the same hill we've been hiking up every day, and walked into the woods kind of where we had been all day, except he was there at daylight, and we had been there probably 2 hours later, completely missing the elk. And like he bugled once, and like the whole herd of elk walked by us at 50 yards, and I shot a bull. So that was kind of my first bull. But then when I started working, I can't remember. I know that the first year I was there, when I started guiding, I had a guy miss with a muzzle loader. I couldn't believe it. It was one of those things where I was like basically bugling and cow calling and raking a tree, doing anything I knew how to do. And I look over, and all of a sudden there's a bull standing there. I'm like, holy shit, that's surprising, you know? And all of a sudden the dude's muzzle loader goes off. There's a big cloud of smoke, and the smoke clears, and the bull's still just standing there. I'm like, all right, well, we're not going to get that one. And then I think I guided a big group of dudes that wanted to, like, split a guide. The outfitter was flexible that way. And so sometime in rifle season, I had, like, six guys in a cabin, and I was guiding all of them, and pretty much that just came down to, like, you know, setting them in different spots for the day, checking in on them, you know, helping them if they got something. And I think that week we killed two, but I wasn't, like, present for either of the shots. I was probably setting them there because someone else had told me, like, hey, this is, like, a good spot. You should have someone sitting here every day. They're going to come through here. I guess technically I killed a few, but it wasn't the next year, I think, that I had like an archery hunter actually kill one with an arrow where I was present. And that probably felt more like my first, you know, guided kill.
So just for timeline's sake, this is what, 20 years ago, 15 years ago-ish?
Yeah, Yeah, no, it's that's probably around 2000 or 2001.
I think I know the answer to this, but what was it like out there as far as popularity with kind of those backcountry hunts and guides and all that kind of stuff? Because I think, you know, one of the things, at least in my life, is people like you guys have opened this idea that, and the internet in general, I mean, there's so much content out there of people going west for elk and mule deer and antelope and all this different stuff. Back 20 years ago, I would have never dreamed of such an idea. And maybe that's just because of my background, but like, has it gained in popularity tremendously over the last 20 years that you've seen, or?
You know, there's two ways to look at that. It's interesting because as an outfitter and guide, like when I first started, they had a very robust sort of backcountry service guided hunt where like the dudes would roll into camp, the guides would have backpacks packed, they would go through the client's backpack, and they would literally go up in to to where there was no services, no support, and basically backpack hunt for a week. And it was like a very popular thing for them. For whatever reason, that really fell off. Like, I never even got to guide one of those. Like, it really fell off. Like, the average client just started really wanting a more cush hunt, right? Or just didn't see the value in, like, so much of the adventure of going on a backpack hunt and the hard work of a backpack hunt. And we're just as happy being in – we kind of had, like, a cabin-based hunt, and then we had a outfitter wall tent kind of a based hunt. And both of them had cooks and, you know, hot water, beds, cots, whatever. It was just more comfortable. So I don't know what happened there and why the average client just didn't want to do that. Maybe it's because, like you're saying, the average guy that was going to do that hunt said, you know what, I can probably just do it on my own without paying for it. And then, you know, as the years rolled on, I mean, that was like, those early years, nobody had a GPS in camp. It wasn't until probably like 05, I think, when I bought my first GPS. And, you know, as anybody knows, man, it's like once you have one of those things in hand and you figure out how to use it, like it makes the world a much smaller place. So I think that, and then the fact that pretty much everyone has one now on their phone has like, that in of itself has just given so many people more confidence, I think, to go out there and experience, you know, backcountry hunting without the need of, you know, say a guide. We talk about it a lot. It's really interesting, right? Because supposedly hunting numbers are down, yet, especially out west, if you're out hunting, it sure seems like there's just more and more people. Like, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, near the trailhead or 10 miles deep and everything in between, there just seems to be more pressure, you know, and, you know, more states, I think, are dealing with that, you know, and coming up with more limited hunts to, you know, limit some of that. I would definitely say it's gotten more popular, and I don't know if it's just like a small group of people doing more, and that's how you sort of explain why, you know, the license sale numbers aren't increasing. There's probably a number that shows that, like, maybe, like, country, I'm trying to think. Like, if there's more licenses sold per person now than there was 20 years ago, you know? Like, if there's more people hunting multiple states than there was 20 years ago.
I mean, that's us.
I would venture to say, yeah. I mean, if personally, what, for I sure. got three this year and yeah. – And I'm not going out west. I'm just kind of staying within the Midwest, but that would have never happened. But then again, I'm at a different point in my life.
I mean, you start making more money, and you got, you know, more opportunity for individuals.
Kids that can wipe their own asses, and you don't have to worry about that. There you go.
It's a good thing getting there. So Colorado, what was the decision or the deciding factor to go up to Alaska? Did you just get bored with it? Was it a job opportunity?
You know, my wife had just finished grad school, and she's looking at just needed kind of a job to, you know, put her new knowledge to work, and sort of like a career stepping stone. And we wanted to go check out something, you know, fun. And so there was a couple options in Alaska, and so we ended up in Fairbanks for not even quite a full year. It was a seasonal position, so I think we were up there for like 9 or 10 months. And then right on the heels of that, she took a job in Salt Lake, and that's what brought us there. And luckily, I was able at that time. I was starting to work for Meat Eater, and I was able to work remotely.
How'd you get tied in with Steve? And what was the timing on that?
So it was while we were in Alaska. His wife, Katie, and I went to high school together. Her older brother and I actually have known each other since fourth grade. You know, she's from Kalamazoo. Steve's from up north in Michigan, Manistee country. But so when they started hanging out, Katie's sort of only reference to hunting and fishing was me. So anytime she wanted to sort of come in on the hunting and fishing conversation, she would just name drop me. And that happened enough times that I think that there's like a couple things that went down. Like my buddy Jay Scott had written an article in Western Hunter magazine, and there's a picture of me glassing, and there's a caption that just said like, Giannis Patelis glasses Colorado High Country or something like that. And he took that to his wife, and she's like, yeah, that's him. At the same time, I think that he actually went on a hunt with Jay in Mexico for Gould's turkey, and Jay and I were working together at the time. I was actually Jay's fly fishing guide for a few years, and then he brought me into the fold, and I started guiding elk hunts and coos deer hunts with him. So he dropped my name a few times as someone that, you know, he was working with. I think something else. Can't remember. Anyways, it was enough to make Steve to just email me and reach out and just say, hey, you know, Katie's always talking about you, just wanted to say hey. And I was in Fairbanks, and he had drawn a sheep tag in Tope, which is not far from Fairbanks. And so when we made that connection, he's like, hey, you should come along and you know, just come on a sheep hunt if you want. And I jumped at that opportunity because living there for 9 months, I'd realized that if you want to go have fun in Alaska, you need a lot of money because it costs money to fly places, to take boats to places, whatever. And so even though we had been doing the best exploring that we could via the road system, you know, to fly into the bush was like a dream come true. So I went and did that, and the rest is history.
Did you get to do any, like, you personally, I mean, how was your hunting success in Alaska in that 9 months? Did you do anything cool?
I personally didn't shoot anything. I took a couple dudes because, again, I wasn't going to be a resident, and just didn't deem, you know, the money I was going to have to spend for, like, I think the only thing that was available, because we got there, like, January, and I was going to be gone for the fall. So that spring, like a couple months later, maybe like in March, two guys that we befriended or were friends with, you know, some of our friends lived in Fairbanks. There's like a late caribou hunt off the Dalton Highway. And I can't remember. It might be cows only that time of year. But basically, you have to be 5 miles off the highway to shoot a rifle. And so we drove all the way up there. In a 2-door Civic hatchback with 3 guys and a dog and all of our gear enough to, like pull sleds. If you've ever heard of a pulk sled, it looks like a really basic plastic toboggan, but it's like $1,000 version of that. And it's got like a metal frame that you attach to your hips. So we carried packs and those, and then pulled those sleds. We were able to drive, I think, 2 miles to a lake, and then we skied another 3 miles on very thin snow. Like a lot, we found a whole pile of caribou antlers because they were just sticking up everywhere. But we skied out there and killed 3 cows so that each of us could have one. But they were the guys that did the shooting. I was just there to help out. They were pretty fresh hunters, so. I, you know, quote unquote, did some guiding up there. But
so to revisit your point from earlier, have a plan to get this giant animal out. You had 3 dead caribou in a Honda Civic. Did you just drive the sleds behind the Civic? How'd you get all that meat home?
I look back on it, and I don't know how we crammed it all in there. I can tell you this, that highway has a lot of frost heaves on it, and every single time we went over a frost heave, those tires would rub, and every single time you just hold your breath and hope that the tire didn't bust.
Man, that's wild.
But yeah, we caribou aren't huge animals, but I'm guessing we still ain't added, 150 pounds maybe of meat and I guess we didn't take out any antlers because they're just like those cows, the little bitty antlers. It was real interesting because they're getting ready to lose to shed their winter coats. So I've never experienced anything like it. But when you went to skin them or like just make the gutting incision, like there was just hair flying everywhere because you could literally just rub your hand across the hide and the hair was getting ready to let loose. And it was pretty interesting because, when we hunt, we never hunt animals in when their hide is in that stage,
It's probably a mess.
That's crazy.
So at the time when Steve came knocking, were you creating, content, with your hunts? Or were you just guiding and hunting yourself?
I was doing a little bit. So my buddy Jay Scott that I mentioned earlier, he had a blog, Jay Scott Outdoors. I believe it's still up. I don't know if he actually adds anything to it these days, but I was writing an article here and there, just basically like a blog post with some pictures just about my adventures. And just through guiding, I had spent a fair amount of time behind a camera, just taking lots of pictures and making sure my clients had, good documentation of their fishing and hunting trips, and I felt like that was like a service a guide should provide. But that was about it, so I was involved a little bit of it, Jay, and I were probably doing a few YouTube videos, that was very much in the beginning of all of that. And so everybody was kind of like wondering like, oh, should we do, videos on YouTube? Is that going to be worthwhile?
Here we are.
So a little bit of that, but not too much. Not too much, I think the reason we flew with the same guys that we flew with on that sheep hunt just a couple weeks ago. I was up there caribou hunting, and I was telling one of the pilots that when we were on that sheep hunt together, the reason I got hired on is because I was sitting around looking through my glass so much and just picking up game, on the hillsides. I think Steve was like, none of you guys on the crew do this at all. It'd be very nice if we had a dude that was just happened to be able to find game, like it's an important part of making a hunting show,
So did Steve kill a goat or a sheep that hunt?
He did. We actually had Paul Meese from Vortex with us, and Steve killed a sheep. Like, I think it might have even been the first day we could hunt. So I think we flew in, landed, packed like halfway up this mountain, and Paul Neese actually went up. It's an episode. You can watch it. It's on probably the Meat Eater YouTube channel right now. But yeah, Paul went up a different ridge, and he was glassing to our ridge and basically saw some rams above us, and kind of did. Played some charades, through the binoculars, we figured out that, we had rams above us. So we were pretty socked in, but in the morning we crept up there. And, just at the right time, the clouds lifted and we were like, 300 yards from two rams, and Steve put the sneak on them and killed them. And then because it happened so fast, I think Paul Neese then actually got a bear tag, and then we went hunting bears for a few days.
So I guess one of the questions I have at this point in the whole saga, did you have any idea that Meat Eater was going to explode into what it has become today?
No, not at all. Not at that point. I mean, I could tell that, what Steve was doing was something different. And, that certainly intrigued me, about the whole thing. I could, his just, his brain power is pretty impressive. You know, that dude's a thinker and then can express his thoughts extremely well. And, you know, that was very apparent, you know, early on. And, you know, I was impressed by, you know, just his sort of, just overall woodsmanship. You know, a lot of us are, at the time, you know, I would have been like, yeah, I'm an elk hunter. That's like really all I would have said I'm an elk hunter and then a trout fisherman, you know. That was very focused. And Steve had a very like broad sort of knowledge of like, you know, a fair amount of different kinds of fishing. He had been a trapper, you know, and then had messed around with all different kinds of, you know, big game here and there. And then when I read a couple, I think I actually maybe read one of his books prior to that trip. And, you know, that's what really like probably flipped the switch for me is I was like, man, this dude's like really making like hunting, I guess just representing hunting in just such a different light than it had been done up until that point. You know, I mean, it's kind of the same, you know, most of us kind of grew up with the same hunting media that was on, you know, whatever, the early days when it was on ESPN and NBC, and then it's kind of slowly switched over to those smaller cable networks. But, you know, Steve's take on it was just so, so fresh and different, even though it's like, what was always weird about it, and even now when people say, oh yeah, like you guys have done so much to, you know, change hunting, this, that, and the other, and so much good for hunting. And I'm like, yeah, but we really haven't, because all we've done is sort of focused on like the hunting that all of us grew up with, because that's all we did. I mean, we just started talking about like the hunting that we had growing up, you know, and how that was. And it was just, I guess it was just different enough from what was portrayed in hunting media that a lot of people were like, oh yeah, this whole program's legit, because they could just relate to it more, you know. But no, the short answer is no, I had no idea it was going to blow up. I mean, I knew that, Steve was going to have some long legs with all of this. And, you know, like anybody, I think at the time I was also just very stoked to sort of have an opportunity to be working, you know, to find, you know, outside of guiding, to find a different way to be working, you know, staying outside, messing around with hunting. You know, because I like being behind the camera, you know, I started getting trained to work the camera, and it was just, you know, for like, again, a guy with no college education, it was like a seemingly decent career path opportunity to, you know, make a decent living and keep doing what I like to do.
So one of the things when you're talking about all your different jobs and, well, I did this for the winter and this in the summer, and I'm one of those people that's like every 2 weeks I have to know where that paycheck's coming from. And I have everything very organized. So to me, some of your adventures would just have blown my mind. I can't really conceptualize a lot of that. So kudos to you on that. But
I'm definitely a trust the process guy. I'll jump off a cliff and be like, we'll figure it out on the way down.
Yeah, so, I've noticed that. That's why we get along well. So
Giannis, when you're out backcountry in Alaska, did Steve talk with you about getting on board with Meat Eater, or did you kind of get that vibe? I mean, when did he give you the job offer? Was it when you were gutting a ram?
Oh, dude, it's too funny, man. We literally had met for the first time when I think I met him, or maybe someone picked me up, and then we went to pick up the rest of the crew at the hotel in Fairbanks. And so I met Steve there, and we took a picture to send to his wife, Katie. And, got in the car together, and we were driving the whatever 3 hours down to Tote, and like halfway there, I almost remember it was like, cause you had to drive by, there's an Air Force base, Eielson, something like that. I think it's like a long stretch when you're driving by the base. I pretty much remember him at that point. So this is like an hour into our drive. He's like, if you're interested in a hunting show, man, I can help make that happen for you. I'm like, huh, that's interesting, but no thanks. I'm like, not, like, I'd be much happier just kind of staying below the radar. I don't need a hunting show, and I don't need to be a, you know, hunting show TV host, and it's just not, you know, not what I'm looking for. And he was like, okay, whatever. So when we got to Tope, the producer at the time, Dan Doty, he said, hey, I got some paperwork for you to fill out so you can, you know, you can get paid and we're covered under insurance or whatever. I was like, oh, you don't have to pay me, man. I'm just here for the ride. Like, I'll be happy to help out, but I'm just stoked to be here and getting a free Bush flight, you know. And he's like, oh, no, we're going to pay you. I was like, oh, all right, well, that's great. It's like paid vacation, you know. And so that's sort of how I got offered, you know, the job of – it was basically on a per-sheet basis at that time. So when they were going out – because I did well on that hunt, and they had a second – they had a caribou hunt planned on the heels of that. And so they asked me if I wanted to go. And the position at that time was – it's still called WPA, which stands for Wilderness Production Assistant. And it just basically means you're just going to do all the grunt work, carry the heaviest bag, possibly run like the long lens camera, you know, run and get water, you know, help people make tents. And because a lot of the, some of the cinematographers, at least at that time, necessarily weren't experienced, you know, backcountry dwellers, so to speak. And so they might need help, you know, just making sure they got clean water, or making sure they got their tent set up right, or making sure that when it starts dumping rain, that they're doing the right things with their gear and, you know, everything to stay dry so they can keep doing their job. But yeah, so that was the job, was WPA. And so I did those two hunts in a row in Alaska, and then they had some stuff coming up in the fall. I did turn down a couple shoots because I already had guiding that I had signed up to do. But luckily, while between shoots, Steve was writing the Meteor's Guide to Hunting, Butchering, and Cooking Wild Game, the first one, the big game volume. And so I started writing on that project and helping put that book together. And so that sort of helped me have work for, you know, billable hours between shoots. And so that sort of just kept building and building. And eventually, you know, I forget how long it took. If it was a year later, maybe, when they actually gave me like a full-time position.
Was Steve like, when Steve's like, hey man, do you want a hunt show? And you're like, nah, I'm good. Was he just kind of shocked, or was he like, all right, that's fine. I was that, I mean, because yeah, if Steve Rinella's like,
I don't think it really shook him one way or another. He's like, you know, just respected my opinion and,
yeah,
you know, moved on.
I mean, because, you know, Giannis, feel like, hey, do you guys want a hunting show? I would literally tell my wife we're moving to wherever today. Like, we're just going to pack her. I'm going to say yes before I even talk to my wife about it. But then she, you know, good for you, man, having that that discipline.
I mean,
so.
You know, at the honestly, I didn't know, you know, I was whatever. How old was I back then? I guess I was like early 30s, and I didn't know enough about it. You know, I didn't know what it would take to be, to have a hunting show, you know, to be a hunting show TV show host. You know, and then I was lucky enough to then, you know, work with Steve for whatever it was, the next 7-8 years, you know, all the way from that WPA position all the way to, you know, getting like the director credit on those shows and doing every little, you know, step of the process along the way, including like directing Steve himself. And getting, but the important part was for me now is that I was able to watch him work on the other side of the camera. And so when they asked me to do that, you know, I have like a really nice, you know, bank of experience to you know, look back on. And, you know, just thank goodness I was paying attention, you know.
So, like, when you're as the WPA or even the director and you're out there, I mean, do you guys get to hunt on some of these episodes? Or is it just, you know, Steve or whomever the meat eater personality is, and you guys are just there for the ride?
Yeah, you're there just to work. Every now and then, like, there would be an instance where whitetail deer hunts, for example, like on a lot of hunts, we're the whole crew is there almost the whole time, except for like the final stalk. You know, you're kind of always there, you know, and the producer / director is sort of overseeing and kind of helping the whole thing move along. Except for, like I said, the final stalk, when Steve and just one camera operator will probably move off to try to get that done. Otherwise, you got, you know, 5 or 6 people, sometimes as little as 4, but 5 or 6 people, depending on if there's a guest on the show, that are together the whole time. Whitetail deer hunts, though, especially archery, like, don't lend themselves to that. Like, I don't know if you've ever hunted with a cinematographer, but, like, that in of itself, you're like, man, I'd probably be having better luck if it was just me hanging out in this tree and not this other dude also here, like, moving around with that big shiny camera, you know? And so there's a couple instances where I would just sort of produce direct, like, every morning, be like, hey, make sure you guys talk about this, talk to the, you know, to the camera operators, make sure you're getting these shots. If you get a deer down, call me, I'll be right there, you know, then we'll kind of go and do it together. But in those instances, if we were on we hunted a buddy of ours farm that's like 600 acres. And so Steve was hunting, Mark Canyon was hunting, there was still plenty of room. And I was like, well, I'm not just going to sit around all day. I'll go sit in a stand too, you know. But for the most part, I'm trying to think if like there's been another meteor hunt where anybody behind the scenes got to actually shoot something.
I've heard a lot of the guys who go through like the Midwest whitetail that Bill Winky would like tease them with hunts, like, okay, you do this and get this done, we'll let you hunt, you know. And I've always wondered if that was something you guys did, like, all right, drag this elk out 5 miles, Giannis, and we'll let you go hunt an elk.
No, when you pack elk out 5 miles, you do get to take some elk meat home. Which, you know, we've always been good about making sure everybody's got a cooler meat to take home. I guess on bird hunts, like I remember on a Texas Sandhill Crane episode, you know, the guys tagged out one day, the birds are still flying, and Steve's like, dude, like, put a gun in Mike's hand, put a gun in so-and-so's hand. And then, like, you know, we get a few more passes and a couple other people shot birds. But big game, I don't think that's really a thing, you know, because it's usually you just don't want to break the flow, you know. Once you've, like, if something is harvested, then you want to go into, you know, capturing all of that, and then that leads to the butchering and then the cooking scene, and then it's just, you know, it's sort of a wrap. There have been a couple times if we finished early and the hunting was good, I would not get the early flight back and stay and hunt. And then maybe extend my trip, you know, if I was like feeling like there was a good opportunity there. But not for the most part, man, you're just there working.
If you had to guess, how much of the time, percentage wise, is the camera actually rolling? Like, you guys aren't, it's not on 100% of the time,
no,
right?
No, not at all, man. That's a good question. It's, I'm trying to think what those guys shot in a day. I mean, if we were, you know, out and about and awake for 12 hours, I think there's a really good chance there could be 3 to 4 hours of footage, you know, per day. Because I don't think it's 50, it's definitely not 50% of the time, but it could easily be a quarter of the time. And I can tell you this, that, you know, most television, if you see a 30-minute episode on television, it's actually only 22 minutes long because of commercial breaks, right?
Right.
And to distill down a hunt where you've been out there for, you know, 5 days is like the minimum. I don't like to make them scrunch them any harder than that. But, you know, sometimes it's a 7-day, or like if it's moose or sheep, like a real big investment, you know, you might be out there for 9 days. And then to cram that into 22 minutes, man, there's a lot left that does not make it, you know. And it can be hard. It's like a hard pill to swallow when it's called a shooting ratio. Like, so sometimes on a big hunt like that, you might be shooting like 100 minutes to 1 minute that actually makes it in, right? In a perfect, there's been a few times where they've managed to shoot a whole episode in 1 day. And, you know, so you brought your shooting ratio down to maybe like 5 to 1 or something like that, which is just incredible. The editors love it because there's just like less stuff to scrub through. They can pretty much just be like, okay, there it is. There's the beginning of the day is the beginning of the show. The end of the day is the end of this show. Somewhere in there, there's going to be, you know, the apex or the hurdle, you know, that the protagonist has to deal with. and then you're going to have your resolution, and then it's over. And it's very nice when it's tidy and compact. To do that over a longer period of time, it gets harder and harder, you know. But that's where, good storytelling, comes into play, and knowing how to, how to tell a story about a 9-day hunt without having to be like, and now it's day 3. We're waking up again. Didn't see a moose on day 3. And now it's day 4. It's raining a little bit. We didn't see a moose today either. You know what I mean? Like, no one wants to watch that. That gets real boring real quick.
My daughter would appreciate it, because every time she has to do something like that, tell us about your day, Annie. Well, I woke up. I brushed my teeth. I came downstairs. Okay, no, I don't need that. Tell me about what actually happened, the important stuff.
I think to your point about the shooting ratios, that's fascinating. 100 minutes filmed, 100 minutes on the show, or 1 minute on the show. I think it's where a lot of the hard feelings for content consumers have come from. Because, I mean, you watch a 22-minute show on Outdoor Channel or whatever it is, and for a guy that just hunts public land, or, that is not shooting these monster, 180-inch deer every year, and you're like, man, that perception is reality, right? Like, you don't see the entire story. You don't see that person on the TV show just hunted for 8 weeks to get you 22 minutes. So I think where that's, I mean, you guys kind of started a lot of that, kind of telling the whole story or more of the story, on Netflix and through other channels. So, I mean, you've been a part of that evolution. What was that like? Just, you're watching content on TV and all of a sudden you're part of the content. I mean, what was kind of the story process that Steve brought you into with Meat Eater? About telling the story, I guess. That's a hard question.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because the show was produced and owned in the early days by a company called 0.0 Productions. They're probably best known for producing Anthony Bourdain shows over the years. But there wasn't a person on that 100-person staff that knew anything about hunting. Besides Steve and I. And I mean nothing. And you would think that would be just terrible. You'd be like, well, how are they going to tell a hunting story, when nobody knows anything? But what was cool about it is that you had all these fresh people for fresh minds that were very interested in hunting and this thing that Steve was bringing to them. But when they would look at the footage or look at the story, totally different things might jump out and capture their imagination or their creative mind compared to if you watched it, And so you would tell a story in one way, but they'd be like, yeah, but what was really neat is when you guys were talking about, X, Y, Z. And even though that's not totally related to how to kill that sheep, that shows just more about it develops the character because the character is talking about something else important in their life or whatever it might be. You know what I mean? But it turned into be a real good chemistry because, those editors would always just sort of be able to find these stories that were in there that, me, I was always pretty much looking at very, linear, how to tell, at least in the early days, how to tell that hunting story the best and keep it the most authentic to, what really happens on the hunt. And with what I learned from them is that, what's really important or what it makes for me engaging content is that you got to become invested in that character, right? You want to know who they are and listen to them talk about what they're thinking about and what's troubling them or what's making them happy. And then same thing with conversations between people, some of the best moments in Meat Eater TV across 11 seasons are when Steve is talking with somebody else. And there's nothing to do about hunting at all. Him and Parker Hall talking about how to spit sunflower seeds out, right? It's totally stupid and goofy, but it's there it is. You're caught in that moment and it's magic, Or when Kevin Murphy, blows his horn for the first time and Steve's holy shit, really? You blow a horn every day when you go hunting? That's amazing, It's been a great educational experience for me, to learn how to, hopefully make, good, engaging, content.
Well, I think it's, I think it's interesting. I mean, you talk about, and they're just non-hunters that are a part of the creative process that see things a different way. You know, I see, you know, I'm scrolling through Netflix. I'm like, oh, Giannis hunting musk ox. I'm in. I'm going to watch that entire episode, right? Or whatever it is. I was at an event for the BHA, and we went fishing in Long Island Sound in New York City. And I was there, you know, 100 people on this boat, and half of them had never hunted and had no desire to hunt, but they loved meat eater. And so, I mean, you guys have done a nice job of telling that story to non-hunters about, you know, this is, it's more than just shooting something, you know, it's talking about spitting sunflower seeds and, you know, breaking the sight off your muzzleloader, you know, whatever it is. So I think that's that relatable. That's such a hard thing to accomplish. And you guys have done a really, really good job. So musk ox, I know you've hunted those. What's some, like, just some crazy stuff that you've gone in, episode or not? I mean, you've been all over. Have you gone out of this country or just stuck to North America for your hunts?
No, we've been to South America twice, making episodes, once to Bolivia and then once to Guyana. Both time kind of did like river access trips where we, you know, basically took these dugout canoe type boats with basically was the equivalent of like a Go Devil, you know, like a mud motor, if you're familiar with those, like a really long shafted, you know, tiller that is able to, you know, bounce over stuff when you hit it. And those are both, the Guyana adventure wasn't quite as wild because it was a little bit more, like just about anybody could call. We might have gotten like a little bit of extra sort of adventure, but you can pretty much call down there and go through the same lodge that is owned and operated by the dude that we went with and go on the same adventure we did, right? They mostly cater to fly fishermen that are looking to catch the arapaima, which is like the largest freshwater fish in the world. But the one in Bolivia, that was like full on felt like, there was a camp ahead of us at the end of the river, like where we couldn't take the boats any farther. But I think that camp had literally been there for like maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And besides that, I don't know when the last time like somebody sort of from the outside world had been up there. Because as you move up the river, you're literally stopping in these little villages. You're passing some by, but we were stopping in villages to pick up dudes that would help us hunt, that would, you know, just help kind of with the whole expedition. And so that had a real, like, just like anymore, man, that's what like I crave. As much as I love going to Wisconsin and sitting in my deer stand, I love that because it's still new to me, even though I kind of grew up doing it. I'm now really applying myself to it. But like, even though this caribou hunt I went on 2 weeks ago, like, and this sounds like highbrow and it's not meant to be at all, but like I've done that trip now, whether it's for caribou or for moose, you know, I don't know, that was maybe my fourth or fifth trip, including the time we went with Steve for the sheep. And like, you kind of know what to expect. And, you know, unless the plane goes down, like there's not going to be like this real adventure, right? You know, you just know what's going to happen. And that Bolivia trip, it was like every day you're kind of like looking over your shoulder and being like, okay, don't mess up. We need to stay safe. We need to, like, you know, don't get bit by some crazy shit because no one's coming to help you. You're not going to get out to like a real hospital for days, you know, at least. I mean, that's the time Steve got hit by that
the bullet ant or whatever.
Yeah, the bullet ant.
What were you guys chasing in Bolivia?
We hunted, trying to think what Steve shot. He and I were to get, because the dudes that were taking us hunting, they didn't want the whole crew out there. But we were like, well, it has to be two of us because Steve's hunting and then there has to be a camera. And so we were trading off every night who got to go into the jungle at night because it was such an experience. Like the jungle during the daytime and the jungle at night is like literally, you know, being, I don't know, like in Africa in one moment and then in the United States in the other. So it's two different worlds. And it's just, you know, you can't understand how loud it can be at night. Like when all the bugs are just going off, it's like this cacophony, white noise, just like intensity, where you kind of feel like you have to be whispering. The dudes wanted us to whisper to not spook game, but at the same time, it's like so loud that you almost feel like you have to talk in a regular voice just so the person next to you can hear you. Anyways, everybody wanted to experience it. And so I think one night we killed a deer. I'm trying to think what else. It was during the daytime when Steve wasn't going to kill a monkey, but the dudes with us killed a monkey. And
I remember
that's when we ate a monkey a few days later, which is pretty wild. I'm trying to think what else. We did a lot of fishing on that trip. We caught some like crazy white and black striped catfish. They had those golden Dorado in that river, which is the dudes that took us were building out an outfit to service, again, fly fishermen that wanted to catch those golden Dorado. It's a, for like people that fly fish the world, that's like, I think a pretty sought after species. So I think there was a chance that we would have shot like, maybe we did shoot some birds. I think there was like a crested curassow was a bird that we were after. I think there was always a chance of, capybara, which is basically like a giant guinea pig. When I say giant, like 40, 50 pound guinea pig.
I'm just going to say this because I know there's other people out there thinking this. Please, you keep going and making those shows because I don't want anything to do with the jungle and the dark and whatever's out there. So we appreciate you for your taking that risk.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that those shows definitely didn't resonate with our audience. And so I think that a lot of people come from that space, like where if you just took, the populace as a whole, or even like the group of hunters as a whole in our country, like there's a lot of people where hunting to them is, and I grew up with those people, like going to Wisconsin deer camp and spending 3 to 5 days there. And that might be it. Maybe you throw in a pheasant hunt there and maybe a goose hunt there, but like, you know, a lot of people's hunting season can be like 10 days or less. And, you know, maybe while you're in deer camp, you actually make it to the field twice out of 5 days, right? That's like a very normal thing. And it's totally fine to be that way. And I think there is like a sliver in there where, like what I'm talking about is like, I like going on those, like the adventures where there's like a really good chance, not really good, but like a solid 50-50 chance on whether you're going to have success or not, and you're just going to have to work hard for it and be up against like some serious stuff. And whether that means climbing up mountains or enduring weather or just enduring like sitting in a tent for 3 days, like all that stuff, you know how we like everybody jokes about type 2 kind of fun, right? Where like when you're there, it's like, oh, this sucks. But then like when you get home, you're like, oh no, that was real, man. That was a good adventure, you know.
Who comes up with these hunts? Because you said the way you do it, Giannis, if you walked in my office, you're like, I have this crazy idea. Night, jungle, bow and arrow, monkeys. Sign me up. Like that's a no brainer. I mean, are you guys just trying to come up with like crazy shit that you can do just to like push the envelope, or is it just? I mean, do you walk into Steve Rinella's office like, all right, this is what I want to do, and it's just this insane like, I want to hunt a walrus with a knife. Like, who's coming up with this stuff?
I mean, it comes from all different creative angles. I mean, I would say that, and it definitely has evolved over the years because early on, it was probably a lot of, and I'm in the same boat now, but probably early on for Steve, it was like, man, I've never done that. I've never been able to do it, but now I can because like we're working. And so there's a budget for it and I can go and experience that hunt or adventure. Right. So there's probably some of that going on where he's like, let's go and do that. Like, I want to go and try. Cause I think the way he originally got to South America was he was down there for a magazine writing assignment, and he met this dude, and the dude was talking about how he bow fished for these vegetarian piranhas, and it's a piranha that basically eats like
vegans,
you know, aquatic vegetation in the rivers. And so once, like, so Steve had that idea, and he came to me, he's like, dude, we got to make that happen. We got to go down there and go bow fish for these, you know, crazy red, you know, vegetarian piranhas. But like, a lot of it, you know, it can just come through an email, man, or just like meeting the right person. Because again, it's like, it's not necessarily the hunt. It's like, that's why I like squirrel hunting, right? It's like, people are like, why would you even go do a hunt on squirrel hunting? It's like, well, because we got to meet Kevin Murphy. Like, that dude is like a treasure of our country. And like, he's just such a cool dude and so interesting. And like, his passion for squirrels is unmatched. And like,
squirrel tacos.
It makes for entertaining television. You know what I mean? And so we went and did it. And, yeah, man, I mean, it's a little bit of everything, you know? And obviously it's like, you don't see Steve, like, I can't even remember. I think there's been one episode where he shot a white-tailed deer. But anytime we've been white-tailed deer hunting, like, he's been taking other people white-tailed deer hunting, whether that was Joe Rogan and Brian Callen or Helen Cho and Brittany Brothers. You know, he grew up doing it. He's kind of, like, had his fill, and he's, like, more interested in, what you know, whatever, doing stuff that he hasn't done. And so that's probably why you don't see him doing too much with white-tailed deer anymore. But yeah, we definitely don't sit around trying to come up with crazy ideas. For instance, we've always wanted to go and hunt these capercaillie grouse, which is like a grouse that's like almost the size of a turkey. And they're over in Sweden, and problem with going overseas, a lot of times there's a language barrier, right? And so we kind of had contacted a few people, and just nothing ever really seemed to get going or clicking. And then finally, we were hanging out with Rob from Spartan Precision that makes the bipods that we use. And he's like, oh, you want to go shoot grouse, capercaillie? Like, I got the dude for you. Just don't take my spot, because, like, I want my spot. And I know when you guys go, you guys are going to get the creme de la creme spot. So don't do that. But like, so he introduced us to the dude that's like, he's, you know, he's like got dogs for these grouse, or he's got these 10-foot skis that we were going to use for these grouse. And we had a trip planned for this December. Unfortunately, it got canceled for, you know, just outside reasons that, you know, no reason to explain, but it got canceled. So hopefully we'll do that. But it's just one of those things, you know, it's like, yeah, it's going to be a good adventure. And I mean, we're going to go all the way to Sweden just to shoot one or two of these big grouse. But I guarantee it'll like enrich our lives, you know.
So in, what is it, 10 seasons now? The Kevin Murphy episode is probably those episodes are my favorite. My kids, they always want, we want to watch the moose one. We want to watch the moose one where Steve gets almost attacked by the moose that was wounded. What, mm-hmm. if you had to pick one episode, what's your favorite episode?
Mm. Well, that's a tough one. It would certainly be something from those seasons of when I was, you know, producing and directing the show. Just because there's, you know, there's moments like if you're there and you make sure your team is there to capture those moments and then they make it into the show, you know, you kind of felt like it all clicked and you did your job and you really nailed it. One of my favorites and certainly a fan favorite is the one with my dad when he shoots the moose. You know, I hear that a lot. People love that episode. And, you know, I can rewatch it and get a kick out of him and Steve arguing about, you know, digital and analog clocks. You know, the one that Steve did a solo one, this is something I get after Steve a lot. He used to do solo episodes way more often. And, you know, there's a very different meat eater episode when he's solo versus when he's got a guest. And you sort of just get a little bit more into the inner workings of Steve's head when he's by himself and he's sort of forced just to, like, talk to the camera. So he did one where we went coos deer hunting. And it was a small crew that time. It was just four of us. And, you know, the episode, there was a little bit of action. We saw some deer. He put a stalk on a buck, and it was the buck that got spooked by a bobcat, which was interesting. And I didn't get one, but, like, he did a lot of talking about his dad and about his dad passing away. And what was cool about that one, too, is that the editor, just when he scrubbed it and watched it, he had this idea. He's like, you know what? I'm not going to put any music to this episode. It's going to be all natural sound. Just wind, birds, you know, boots on rocks. That's it. No music at all. And now that you hear about it, you should go and watch it, because, like, it maybe most people can watch it and probably not even notice that it didn't have any music in it. But, like, I just remember that episode coming back after the first cut. We usually go through three cuts. Like, you get, like, the first cut, you get some notes, second cut, you get some notes, and then it's usually after that, they're not going to really take any more notes from you. They're like, if you didn't catch it at this point, it's too bad, like, we're moving on, and they got to get into, like, the coloring phase and, you know, tweaking everything to make it look right. But that was an episode where when the first cut came, and I think Steve and I even got to watch it together, because we were, whatever, working on some other project, and we watched it. And it was one of those things where you just watched it and you're like, holy shit, man. Like, that, like, we were speaking more about the editor, and obviously we put a lot of work into getting it too, but it was just like, man, he nailed it. Like, just hit it out of the park. Like, we really didn't have, you know, any serious notes to give about it. Like, it was just all there. It was a beautiful, you know, piece of work. And, you know, just something you can feel proud of. You know, when it comes together that nice, and you know it's going to be a home run.
I'll have to watch that episode. I've got two more questions, Giannis. If you have time. So, the first question you just talked about just popped in my head. You said you've got three cuts that you go through. Is there anything that you've ever pulled, like, that you've watched or Steve watched, and you're like, absolutely not, that's not going in, take it out, that it's just funny or embarrassing or just, you know, just something that you're like, that's not going in, I refuse to let that happen?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you have to save yourself or save somebody from whatever. Steve and I have argued sometimes. There's definitely been over the years times when like, and it necessarily maybe wasn't Steve, but it could have been a guest that, say, shot three times or even four times. And I'm always like, we got to put it all in there, because that's how it goes. We got to show that. And Steve's like, you know what? I really don't think it's going to add that much to it. It's like, it gets to be egregious. And so we've kind of had like a conflict about that over the years. So there's definitely some times when, you know, you can apply whatever reasoning you want to it, but there's like that where it's just like, you know what? It's not going to benefit us to really go down that, you know, route and show five shots. We're going to keep it to one or two, you know. And we've never done it where it's like, oh, it was five, and we made it look like the person killed it on one shot. Like, we still want to show that, you know, something went wrong, then they had to follow up. You know, you've obviously seen it on the show where it's like there's imperfect shooting, you know. And but the decision to make to tell that story but not have to show it through five shots going boom, you know, might be something we take out. Other times when just, like, if it's something that's embarrassing to, like, if it's embarrassing to me or Steve, like, I think we would just, like, always put it in there, because we just sort of are, like, we think that that is relative, right, to show you slipping or falling or sliding or whatever it might be, missing. Like, it stinks at the moment to have to show that on TV, but, like, we always get great feedback when we do that. But there was a time when it was a dude that, like, just because of his career and his title, like, should be known to be, like, a pretty tough person. And they had a clip in there of him, like, jumping a creek. And when he got to the other side, he kind of, like, slipped and just kind of not quite face planted, but definitely just, like, all fours on the ground. And I was like, you know, I don't know if we need to show that, you know, that guy, right? Like, that this is who he is, and that's what everybody thinks he is. Like, let's keep him, you know, as, like, a dude that's almost infallible, you know, for these 22 minutes. So I don't know. I'm trying to think of other things that I've like I've taken out. I've been more probably nitpicky on just like when it comes down to the sequence of events, when you're talking about seconds and like from one shot to the next in like the hunting sequence, I want those, because it's all boiled down to probably 30 seconds, even if it was a 10-minute long stalk and, you know, this, that, and the other. But I don't want to see, like, a clip of, like, the deer on the left side of the tree, but then when he gets shot, he's on the right side of the tree, but he was going to the left. You know what I mean? And The editor, maybe it just, like, didn't, like, compute to him that, like, oh, yeah, the deer can't be past the tree, and then he's before the tree when he gets shot, because they don't walk backwards normally. Right, but stuff like that, like in those moments, I've tried to make it like as real as possible and make sure that all that stuff is just like dialed into a T, that, you know, that if the turkey's already looking at the camera, you don't then cut to Steve lifting up his gun, right? Because you don't get to pull that off in real life, right? I mean, maybe you do, but most of the time you don't. Like the gun better get lifted up before the turkey starts looking over at you, you know? So I've been nitpicky on that kind of stuff. Trying to think, like, what if there's anything like really serious that I've been like, oh, we got to take out.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I mean, you answered it pretty good. There was some good stuff there. I was hoping for like, oh yeah, Steve did something really dumb or fell on his face, you know, whatever it is. But I mean, that's because we all do it, right? Like, we all know that there's something that.
Yeah. No. And honestly, man, I would always. Be fighting to keep that kind of stuff in there, because I think it just makes it relatable, you know. Yeah. That it's just not that everybody's perfect and it's always a perfect hunt and it's just success, because it's not how it goes, you know. And you know, people, I mean, it's not like it's a secret formula, right? Like the protagonist or the hero has to struggle in a story for there to be like sort of this outcome to where then you like cheer him on or her on at the end. Right. If they just have success the whole time and then he ends or she ends with success, you're like, eh. Right. But if you saw him get kicked down and beat down and whatever, and then they struggle through something, then all of a sudden when there's the resolution, you know, you're like, yay. Yeah. You know,
I agree with that 100%.
Personal. Yeah. You guys have this awesome just empire, man, Meat Eater. You guys have done wonderful things, you know, for hunting, for anglers, for the perception of what we do.
Conservation.
I mean, you guys are, I mean, I think you've really saved an industry, quite honestly. What's kind of the next evolution of Meat Eater? What can we look forward to?
Oh, boy. I'm trying to make the next Meat Eater.
TikTok, right? That's a...
I don't know if it's necessary, and I'm not saying that it's me necessarily hosting, but I'm always, you know, when I have to be like introspective about that and then look to the future, I like to think back to like, you know, how we got here and what made us. And it's like, you know, without Steve and that Meat Eater show, you know, none of this other stuff, you know, First Light wouldn't have had the success that they've had, and you know, Meteor as a company, you know, wouldn't have become what it is. So I think that, you know, we need to stick to, you know, really good hosting and find that in, you know, people and either, you know, bring that out of them, you know, or you know, and or just find the natural talent that has it and continue to, you know, work diligently at, you know, being really good storytellers. And, I think that's sort of that should be like the leading edge of the sword. And then if we continue doing that, then we'll have, you know, the success that comes with it, you know. I'm personally starting to work more with First Light. Like Steve and I have always sort of been, I guess, like the second tier over of like, you know, the first people that a lot of times would get, you know, to look at, you know, gear that was coming out and doing some field testing. But for a long time, by the time we would get a look at it, even if we had issues with it, it would be so far in production that, you know, maybe you could or couldn't make a change, or maybe you can make small change, but you couldn't make big change because, I mean, it's just the way that you know, the business of building gear is. You know, there's timelines and they're long and stretched out, but we've actually now made it even longer, almost added a whole year to the process, so that not only I, but anybody that's, you know, that does field testing for First Light can really wear the product for at least a full fall season, because that's when most of us are using it, before there's any talk of like sending then said product into, you know, sort of like for final and factory production, right? So I'm pretty excited about that, because I think it's just going to help us like really step it up as far as, you know, bringing the best hunting gear to the market. And it's cool now, like we're already looking at stuff that's coming out, that's going to be coming out in 24 that we started working on a year ago. And so we're going to be gear testing it now, because we talked about it a year ago. So we've got like the first sort of, you know, rendition of them. It might even be the second rendition or iteration of said product, but a bunch of us are going to get to now work on, you know, live in it, test it, you know, tweak things. And it's cool, because we know like the goal is to have it come out in 24, but we're like so far ahead that we know that if something's wrong, it can be fixed. So yeah, I'm pretty excited about that, you know, and really, really being able to tell the story of how we, you know, got in very early on a lot of this product design, and, you know, kind of were able to help see it all the way through to something that's, you know, tangible, and that, you know, I can personally feel very proud of and stand behind it, because I know, you know, what it took to, you know, to build that piece of gear. So,
it's personal.
As far as content goes, man, we're going to keep making Meat Eater. We're going to keep making, you know, all kinds of content. You know, my show is slated for, you know, more seasons, which is On the Hunt. For those of you out there that haven't listened or seen it, and you can see that on the Meat Eater YouTube channel. But, yeah, man, we're going to keep doing our thing, making content, you know, and hopefully keep it for free so everybody can keep watching it, you know?
Yeah.
I think from an outsider's perspective, everything you guys touch turns to gold. So, but I think a lot of that has come from the hard work and everything that you've put into it. So keep it up. And I think, you know, everything will keep heading in the right direction.
Where can people find you on social media, Giannis?
It's my name, so it's Giannis, J-A-N-I-S, and then _ Putelis, P-U-T-E-L-I-S.
Outstanding.
And that's on Instagram. I don't do Facebook or TikTok. I'm too young for Facebook, too old for TikTok.
That's fair. It's all good. So, yeah. Well, we really appreciate your time, and good luck the rest of this season. And we're looking forward to seeing what you guys put out.
Right on, man. Good chatting with you guys.
Thanks. Giannis.